Hang on a second, Greg, you need to like, hey there, and welcome back to the Direct Selling Accelerator podcast. I'm your host, Sam Hind, and...
I'm Greg.
Welcome to the podcast, Greg. It's great to have you.
Oh, wow. Thanks, honey.
Today is going to be a little bit of fun. We had the honor and privilege of interviewing someone we have admired for many, many years, the incredible Jim Penman, founder of Jim's Mowing. Now, if you're an Australian, you know exactly who we're talking about. If you're not, Greg?
So Jim, he's one of my childhood people that I used to look up to. Now, I didn't have close contact with him. I just saw this amazing thing getting built around Australia. But he's got 5,300 franchise businesses under his arm, well over $500 million a year in turnover, and some incredible wisdom for us today.
Now, this is a man who started this incredible franchise it started up in 1982. So before I was born, sorry, this is saying a lot about my age, but what my point is, he's been running this business for many, many, many years. But most importantly, he started it with a $24 investment and a company today that, of course, is doing amazing things. But what I loved about this interview was I went into it having never met Jim before, not really knowing where the conversation was going to go. That's always what makes the best podcast interview. But what I loved was how real, relatable, and honest Jim is. And I can tell you right now, if you want to have a good laugh and you want to listen to someone being a true Aussie in business, this was it.
And Sam, I love that we don't need to pretend that we are recording this intro before, because we know what actually happened in this episode. So Jim had some incredible wisdom about balancing family and business and some incredible ways of dealing with difficult customers and the way that he turns that around, and he's actually built his business on how he deals with difficult customers. I am blown away.
So we're not going to say too much more. I'm just going to tell you, you got to listen to this episode. It was a lot of fun. We learned a lot, and Jim shares a lot of amazing wisdom and advice along the way as well. So as always, grab your pen and paper, because there's a lot of golden nuggets dropped in this episode. Sit back and relax and enjoy our interview with the incredible Jim Penman, founder of Jim's Mowing. Well, welcome back into the Direct Selling Accelerator podcast. I'm your host, Sam Hind, and today you're also joined by the awesome Greg and, of course, a very, very special guest today. Welcome on in, Jim. It is such an honor and a pleasure to have you with us.
It's good to be here.
It's great to have you, Jim. And look, we're going to be chatting a bit about, of course, your background, your business, etc. But before we get in, I just want to ask, I did have the question for you, what's one fun fact about Jim? But then reading through your bio, I'm thinking there are so many amazing things that we can ask you about your background, because whilst, of course, you're the founder of Jim's Mowing, which is an iconic franchise business in Australia, of course, there's so much more to you than Jim's Mowing. So start by telling us one fun fact about you that you think is a fun fact.
Well, I got 10 kids.
Okay.
You win. That is cool.
Wow. Okay. And we thought we were doing well at five.
That's one of my absolute favorite things. I've got 10 children. I love them dearly, and I think that's part of my life achievement.
That's amazing. Fantastic. Well, we've just had our fifth and our last, so that's double that. I can't imagine. What are the age ranges, Jim?
Fifth is very good. Fifth is doing well. Congratulations.
How old are they, Jim?
Everything from 39 down to 14.
Wow. So, okay, you're still doing teenage years.
Yeah. I've got my son. I just drove him to school this morning. A wonderful kid. We were talking about it. He's actually reading. He's a 14-year-old, and he's reading SPQR about the Roman Republic, which is an amazing thing. He's a great kid. Everybody loves it.
I love it. Well, my hat goes off to you. I think that's amazing. Well done. And Jim, you know, in reading about your bio, I love the bits of the story that I know. I'm really excited to hear more of it from you today. But You started Jim's Mowing back, was it over 40? Yeah, over 40, 42 years ago now. Is that right?
Well, in a sense, I've been actually gardening since I was 8 years old. So except for about 3 years in later high school, I've never not had a gardening business of some kind. I started a part-time business in 1970, just doing some gardening. I kept it on as got a lawnmower during my student years, and then 1982 I went full-time. So that's, and then in 1989 I franchised. So it's really a case of when did I start, back when I was eight or back when the franchise started. You pick your date.
So I've been very quiet so far because I've been a little bit starstruck. It's actually quite funny. I'm laughing at myself here because when I was a kid and driving around town, you would see these Jim's Mowing vehicles. And so this is a franchise that has not only gone all around Australia, and it's huge around Australia, there are, I believe, three other countries that it's also gone around, and it's gone from Jim's Mowing to Jim's Antennas, Jim's Cleaning. There's a whole bunch of other franchises. So I'm really excited to unpack, Jim, about how it's become, you know, it started off as you said, as a child gardening to, and then I know that you were doing your PhD and you needed some funding to carry you through that. And then suddenly you've had this amazing thing that's blossomed out of it. I'm just amazed to hear how this is all developed.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it sudden, Greg. It's taken a long time, a lot of mistakes. Look, there's a very simple principle, which is what I say to anybody. It doesn't matter in business how smart you are. It doesn't matter how much money you've got. It doesn't matter how good looking you are or how charismatic or anything else. What matters is that every day you look at your business and say, how can I do better? And everything that I've done, it's not one big thing. Even it's thousands and thousands of little things. Every day of my life, I still ask myself the question, how can we improve?
Yeah, that's a really good one. And I'm actually curious to know how you went from it being, because initially you had your side business, which was gardening, to fund you getting through university. How do you go from it's a side business to actually, I'm going to turn this into my career? What was that transition?
Well, it's basically, in technical terms, it's a need to pay the rent, okay? So that's, of course, I was a student for so long.
Yeah.
And at the end of 1982, I was married. I'd finished my PhD. I was deeply in debt, about $30,000 in debt, and I didn't know how to do anything else besides mow lawns for a living. So it wasn't exactly a – but also the other thing was my PhD work was done in history, which is trying to understand the rise and fall of civilizations. And then actually, as I worked through it, I actually figured that it was a matter of biology. To actually do something about the problems I could see, you had to understand the biology, which means a completely different area of science. And since I had no academic career, because my ideas were wildly unorthodox, there was no possibility of academic career. My only solution was to actually become rich enough to found my own research institute. So it's kind of that. So it's a combination of needing to pay the rent, needing to support my family. We started having kids fairly soon after that. And the desire to build this foundation, this research foundation, which we now fund to several million dollars a year.
Yeah. So Jim, I've got to come straight back to that. Are you saying that was part of the vision back in 1982 that you were hoping to become wealthy enough to fund this research that you had no other way of funding?
I wasn't hoping to become, I was expecting to become wealthy enough.
That is key. Yeah. I love that.
Is that something that you learnt from, how do you get to that place? I feel like the getting to that point of expectation versus hope and wishing and praying is something that many people never, ever do. And I'm wondering how you got there so early on in the piece.
I just never considered the possibility of failing. I didn't think my mowing business would do it. I thought it'd be something else, but I just knew I had to do it. And I just was going to do it somehow. I don't know where that comes from. Is it a matter of character? Is it a matter of what?
Sounds like a strong enough why, doesn't it? Like to understand that this biology impact that others are not studying is important enough that you need to. That sounds like a pretty powerful why.
Yeah, of course, I had to do it. It really wasn't a choice. It was just something that I had to do. It was,
So where does that passion come from? I mean, you've sort of made it sound like you just kind of woke up one day and went, oh, well, this is something that I have to do. But, I mean, there must have been a moment in time where you, that strong why became a big why for you.
Well, basically it came through my PhD years, and I was trying to understand the reasons for the rise and fall of civilization, and it became very obvious that we are going through the same process of decline and decay. Mm-hmm. And that just seemed to me horrifying from the point of view of a nation, but the point of view of my family, my children, my grandchildren, those kind of things. So, yeah, it just, as soon as it became obvious that there was a problem,
yeah,
and I could figure out how to solve this potentially, then I had to do it. I never really thought about the possibility of not doing anything else.
Yeah. So tell us a little about that and how Jim's Mowing, you know, which to many people is, you know, and we've got a global audience, so there are many people that may be listening to this that are saying, we don't know what Jim's Mowing is. We'll obviously get to that in a little minute, but for most of our Australian friends, you know, of course, they know this business. They've been seeing it around for many, many, many years. How does Jim's Mowing help that? And, you know, what's your vision for the future? I mean, that's a pretty big legacy to leave. That's pretty exciting. So I'd love to hear more about how Jim's Mowing, you know, is helping towards that.
Well, Jim's group is the funding. I have a fairly good income these days. I'm not as rich as people think I am because I'm a lot more famous than I'm rich, but it's still, you know, I make decent money out of it and live quite comfortably and put the vast majority of my sources into this project. So it provides the funding for it.
So Jim, one of the things that I think is going to meld in here beautifully. So far, I've gleaned that you are a family man, so 10 children, and you've got this big vision, not just about community, but actually broader than that, civilization. So in the midst of that, you've got 5,000 franchises in underneath you, and predominantly, I would guess, the majority of those people at the beginning at least would have been men. And so I'm guessing that you've got a heart not just for your family, not just heart for civilizations, but for some people in the middle of that as well.
Oh, yeah. I'd say that looking after my franchisees is part of my purpose in life. I take it very personally. Every single one of my franchisees has my phone number and email address, and they contact me. Even so far this morning, I've had 3 or 4 different franchisees contacting me about different things. One of them is an ex-franchisee who wants to come back. So I told him how it works, and I said, we'd love to have you because you're a great franchisee, and we talked about the problems he had and why he had to leave. And I said I'd help him in any way I could. Someone else was asking for advice about getting more work, not getting enough work. So I was writing back about things like different ways he could promote his business and so forth. So that's just fairly typical of my day.
Yeah.
So it is a moral purpose. It's a sense of, to me, you've got to have a meaning in life. You've got to have a purpose in life. And yeah. And my business, my family, my research is my purpose.
So when I've spoken to gardeners in the past, I've got a sense that a lot of them have had a low self-worth. And, you know, in my experience, when we've had gardeners, quote, on jobs for us, there's been some really low hourly rates. And I've looked and I've wondered, you know, that absolutely, and I see it again and again. And so the thing is that those blokes that have come to here have been family men. They've had things that they contribute to the community. They help at schools. They're practical people. They're the first people to jump in and help do stuff. And yet they're struggling. And oftentimes they'll also be people who are overloaded with work. They've got so much work, they don't know what to do. And yet they're charging so little. So when I looked up some information beforehand, Jim, I saw the turnover of the group. I saw the number of franchisees. And I noticed that the franchisees make a healthy income on average per franchise. And I thought, well, that's a really good sign. So I'm gathering that that's actually also an important part of the structure that you provide for these guys. Have you experienced the same issue with needing to help people with self-worth and charging and actually bringing in business and all of those things?
I don't know why they call it self-worth. I wouldn't think my franchisees are generally lacking in sense of their own value. But look, you're right to the one of the problems we come we come across a lot is the fact that people don't charge enough. We would recommend that any experienced franchisee within gym should be able to make at least $70 an hour.
Mm.
Now, someone make a lot more than that. Obviously, when they're new, they might struggle, but $70 an hour is reasonable. That means, you know, and it's not that difficult too. You're doing somebody's lawn. Typical lawn could cost, you could charge, say, $60. It'll take you, say, 35 minutes. So allow a bit of traveling time and so forth. But then if you clean the gutters, you could charge an extra, say, $100, $200 for that. And that might take you 3/4 of an hour. I mean, that's, you can make very good money. The problem we have is that what franchisees tend to do is to get busy, and they usually get busy fairly quickly, especially for divisions like mowing and fencing where there's a lot of work. And then they get to the stage where they stop taking new leads. But what they really should be doing is going back to the existing customers and raising prices and charging more and quoting more. If people don't like that, they can drop out. But surprisingly few do if they're happy with the service. And then you get your hourly rate up and up and up. And really, $70 is recommended, but it's certainly not maximum. There's people who can, you know, and I routinely pay that to franchisees who do all kinds of work for me, probably more than that, actually.
Mm. And so, Jim, how do you go from I'm running this business myself as you're doing it to I think I can franchise this? How did that evolve?
Well, it started off when I was, first of all, I was mowing lawns myself. That was, say, 1982. And then I started to get a lot more work. So I started to put subcontractors on, which was not a very good way to do it because the quality of service wasn't very good. And then I came across a situation where, and in fact, I'd done my PhD, but I hadn't been awarded it. My thesis was knocked back. Okay, so my supervisor said, look, you spent all this time, you might as well, if you can rewrite it in this particular section here and methodology and stuff, you'll get it, you'll get your PhD. So I thought, okay, I'd like to do that, but I need some time. So what I had is I had some lawn mowing customers I was looking after that I started to put the business on the market, which is just through the paper in the classifieds in those days. And there was some negotiations, some people were interested, somebody came forward, they came to buy it. But all the time that was happening, I was picking up more and more regular clients. So by the time I actually had this business ready to sell, to pass over, I had another full-time business. So I thought, okay, I have to try that again because I'm still kind of busy. So I advertised again, have somebody interested. Same thing happened. By the time they actually were coming to take over, I was, again, flat out. So I actually had to sell three different businesses to be able to get off the tools. And then I had a bit of money and then I had some time and I finished my PhD and I eventually got it, okay? But I was looking at this and I was thinking, wow, okay, all right. I'm actually going to make more money by building up and selling lawn mowing rounds than I am by just mowing lawns myself. So I switched to a business which was based on getting people into business, helping them into business.
Yeah, wow.
So that was the start, and I had this little business that was going along, and it was pretty good. I actually paid off my debts, and I bought a house, and so we're doing all right. And then this company called VIP came in and messed everything up. This was an interstate franchising, mowing franchise organization. I'd have vaguely heard about, well, that doesn't matter, they're in Adelaide, it doesn't affect me. And they came to Melbourne. So basically I panicked. I really thought these guys were going to crush me. They had like 250 franchisees, which to me that was gigantic. And they had all these offices and uniforms and signage and logos and all this stuff. I had no clues about how to do it. I actually approached them and said, listen, I rang the state manager, said, I'm Jim from Jim's Mowing. You know, what if I just helped to build VIP in the state and, you know, work with you guys? So he said, no thanks. So I thought, all right, well, I can't join them, so I better try and at least compete with them, otherwise they will just crush me. So I actually went to the expo, that was in 1988, and I went up to the stand, took the badge off, so I didn't know who I was, and just said, I'm interested in VIP, can you tell me about it? And they told me about it. And then the state manager came and threw me out because Danny said, that's Jim, don't tell him anything else. But I looked at it and I thought, okay, these guys have got a decent system. I can see reasons why you join VIP and continue to pay fees, which I hadn't really understood before. But I reckon I can do a deal which will be more favorable to franchisees. Because that's the crucial thing. You've got to be able to attract franchisees.
Yeah.
So I eventually launched mid-89. Signed my first franchisee then. And at the start, somebody said to me, if it's successful, how many franchisees do you think you might have one day? And bear in mind, I was just trying to survive against VIP. I wasn't thinking of anything great. And I said, well, look, I don't know if it's going to work, but maybe if it works really well, one day I could have 100. And it turned out somewhat better than that.
So today, can we just clarify, it's over 5,000 that you have, is that correct?
It's about 5,300 last time I checked, yeah.
And how many franchise types? So there's gyms mowing, gyms cleaning, gyms, there's all the gyms. How many in total are there?
Oh, I think there's a bit over 40. But,
so maybe that was the 100 you're aiming for. Maybe you've got 55 left to go, Jim.
Well, having a whole lot of divisions isn't particularly good. The ones we like are the ones that have got at least 50 franchisees. If you've only got one or two, it's a bit of an embarrassment. We try to have divisions that can grow.
Yes.
50 is serious, and 100 is good. And the top ones, like mowing, is like a bit over 2,000 these days, and cleaning is catching up fast. So,
yeah. So what ended up happening with VIP? I've got to hear the end of this story.
Well, they're still doing okay. As far as I know, they may still have 250. Probably not quite that many. But
they didn't come back away to you, Jim, and say, actually, we'd like to talk to you about working together.
Oh, well, Bill and I, the head of VIP, have a good relationship. We have a chat every now and then. We actually met once. So he's a good guy. I respect what he's achieved. And I owe a lot to them. I actually said to him once, Bill, why don't you copy what we do? Because obviously it's working a little bit better by this stage. And he said, well, my guys wouldn't let me. I don't quite know what that means.
I think there's a lot to be said for learning from your competitors like you did. It's such a clever thing that you did. I think a lot of people avoid, their competitors. They don't want to learn from them because they think we can't be anything like them. We have to be totally different. But the thing is that, you know, that's trying to reinvent a wheel, and we all know that that can be a big waste of time in business.
Yeah,
what do you think are some of the skills that set business owners apart, Jim, that are successful versus not?
Well, it's a relentless aim to be better. That's the one thing that distinguishes business success from anybody else. The people who we divide franchisees into three groups: gold, bronze, lead. Gold is somebody who is constantly looking at what they're doing and saying, "How can I improve?"
Mm-hmm.
Bronze, which is most franchisees, are people who are willing to be guided. And you talk to them and you help them and they'll learn and they'll listen and you can coach them and you can mentor them. And maybe hopefully some of them can become gold, but that's the process. Then you have leads, and leads are the ones that don't listen. If you say to them, you say, oh, no, you know, it's not, I don't have to do this. Like, it's like a franchisee who says, I'm not getting enough leads, which can happen in the early days. So, okay, so you go back to them and you say, okay, what you need to do is this. You need to work on your doing free services, which we'll pay you for. And this is how you can do it. You do it through social media, and you can do it through franchise from other divisions, or you can upsell, or you can do this and you can do this. So you give them a whole raft of things, and they come back and say, no, I want more leads. I want more leads.
Give them
to
me.
They're not listening to what you're saying.
Yeah.
They just say, I want more leads. Give me more better quality leads, leads to convert better. And then you go back to them and say, well, why aren't you converting? Because other people are converting leads better than you are. You know, you're only getting 1 in 4. They're getting 3 out of 4. What's the difference? And they say, oh, you're giving me crap leads. I want more leads. I want more good leads. You've got to find me more leads. Can you get that idea?
Yeah.
And that is that is what we call a lead response. Somebody who just won't listen, won't learn. They won't look at themselves because it's good to have the outside world adjust to you, but you can't control it. What you can control is what you do yourself.
Yeah, I love that. That's really powerful. And Jim, you said something before. I just want to touch base with you about, you know, I think when a business grows really big, you've got to start looking, of course, at what do I delegate? What tasks do I delegate onto someone else? But one thing that you haven't ever delegated, and you've been quite open about, is the fact that you make yourself personally available. You've got over 5,000 franchisees now, and you still make yourself personally available to each and every one of them. why do you feel that that's so important to continue doing, and what other tasks do you believe shouldn't ever be delegated if you want to run a successful business?
Yeah, I do very odd things compared with anybody I've ever heard of. I not only do I have daily direct contact with franchisees and, of course, franchisors, but I also do with customer complaints. If any customer rings the office twice with a problem that's not solved the first time, I will get involved with that, come down fairly hard, and until something's done about it. So I work at depth, you might say. I find that's very useful. First of all, because I have a really strong heart for my franchisees. It matters a lot to me. I mean, I get a tax bill, unexpected tax bill for $1 million, and a franchisee business is failing. Let me tell you, the tax bill is minor by comparison with the hurt I feel when I can't help a franchisee. That's just the way I feel about it.
Yeah.
And I'm very passionate about customer service. I just have that emotional driver. Now, it's very useful because I can help people, but it's also a way of understanding what's going wrong. Because basically our prime clients are our franchisees. I want to know why we're not helping them, why we're going wrong, what did we do wrong? Did we not coach them? Did we not train them well? Our IT system is not good enough. Is our selection system not good enough? Did we put people through we shouldn't have had? What can we do to improve that? And you don't actually learn that unless you actually speak to the people at the coalface. And I think too many CEOs are so, they're wrapped up in their systems and structures and organizations, they don't really know what's going on. So I know what's happening. I know why clients are unhappy. Every single, about 30% of our clients respond to a survey, which we send out. So we're talking about hundreds of thousands a year. I personally read every bad survey, every single one. And I'm looking at ways to improve that. So that relentless focus on the coal front of what you're doing. And I have to say, there's another reason why I do this. It's because in terms of doing most jobs, I am completely crap. I am a lousy manager. I have no knowledge about accounts. I don't understand social media. I'm not particularly good at marketing. All right. So the fact is I'm so bad at doing everything else. That's one thing that I can do.
I love that. I just want to quickly check on something here. You know, when you're dealing with customer feedback, particularly what I like to call the squeaky wheels, and also in your case, franchisees who are maybe not in every case, but I'm sure that when you put your email and your phone number out there, I'm thinking, don't you then get hounded by the squeaky wheels or the way you say the leads? You know, the you're going to hear more from the people who are the lead potentially than the gold. You know, how do you deal with that, and how do you filter through a good use of your time versus someone who's just, you can't keep happy no matter what you do?
I'm not particularly chummy about certain things. If I will give a person some fairly straight advice and tell them to follow it, and often by emails and capitalize, it's vital that you do this. So I'm not the sort of person you normally, I'm not a sort of a counselor, if you like. I'll give people very directly and quickly what they need to know. And if they want more, I'll tell them, if you want, like God spawned just before I spoke to you, there was a particular guy who was wanting more help, and I gave him the basic advice that you've got to do this and this and this and this and this. And then he wanted to talk about coaching, and I said the best person for that is your franchisor, because they're the ones who are going to help you on a weekly basis. That's what they're supposed to do.
Yeah.
So I kind of, no, I don't find myself all overloaded with it. Look, seriously, one of my biggest problems is people don't ring me enough. They don't contact me enough. Sometimes I don't hear from people until I've been weeks into a problem. Like a person might be unable to start for several weeks because of some bureaucratic problem.
Yeah.
And then they contact me eventually. So, look, I know you're really busy. I didn't want to trouble you. I say, I wish you contacted me 3 weeks ago when it started. I was like, it started that day, and they're out there making money and getting work. And why didn't you contact me in the past? And one of the things I do is I go around. We've got training on now. We've got about 130 people in training. It's been a big group. We do that every 3 weeks. And I actually try, and I not only speak 2 sessions, but I actually try and greet every single person at least once, hopefully twice. Wow. During that, make some personal contact. I don't shake hands because you get infected. I bump fists with them. And hopefully after they've met me, they're not scared to contact me if they need to. So, and yeah. I hit them again and again. I said, I'm going to write to you in a month's time to ask how you're going. And I'm going to be really hurt and offended if you don't respond to me. And when they do respond, which most do, then I write back to them very quickly so they know that I'm contactable.
Yeah, wow.
So that's just so, so powerful, Jim. And I think it alludes to what you were saying before about, you know, you've said your strength is not management and all of this other stuff. You leave the finances to others to some extent. But I just love that you've actually got what matters in your business, which is the people. So it's the customers, it's the franchise people in the middle, and it's making sure that it all works. Because if you're on top of those things, it works so well. Mm. How did you go, though, from it being just you and as you started to explode in growth and, you know, if you felt that you weren't the numbers man or the day-to-day manager, but you wanted to be in these other areas, how do you get through that growing pain to when you can have someone amazing full-time in that position?
Well, it's very difficult, and I made a lot of terrible mistakes. I mean, I would say that's been my biggest weakness, finding quality people, especially at the top level. But you've got people like Joel. You've dealt with Joel. You know what he's like. You know, this was a kid who came to me. He was like 21 years old, basically a law student. He came and did a very basic, unskilled, casual job for us. I think he was moving files or something like that, something very minor. But he was okay, so we put him on full time, and then we got him into the insurance section. He was helping the insurance guy, and I used to go. I just wander around and chat to people during the day on my rounds. They called it my rounds, and I make jokes with them and ask what they're doing and stuff. And this Joel, this young kid, was very. He had a lot of ideas. He was talking about the website and how it could be improved and this kind of stuff too. So I got to know him a bit from this, and then later on he took another role in national office, and he developed these skills of being a social media. So it's kind of like we often tend to promote from within. A couple of my top managers are actually people who just started, most of them actually started from the very basic level. It's the sort of the mailroom idea. So you just get to know them, and then you look at people who've got talents. I'm always looking for who's got ideas. There was one lady that actually was working in a very junior role for us, and she was doing quite well, and I gave her a pay rise. And this is talking a single mother in her 40s, early 40s, and she had tears in her eyes. She said, "Nobody has ever given me a pay rise ever in my whole career. This is more than 20 years in the workforce, never got a pay rise. She's now one of my best managers."
Wow.
She's so dedicated. She's always coming up with ideas. She's amazing. Megan is just amazing. But you have to know people a bit. You have to listen to them and see what they're capable of.
Yeah.
Whereas I find people from corporate backgrounds and stuff often don't do very well because they don't understand we're very entrepreneurial at Shims. It's very personal. You know, I can sit down with my COO, we have a discussion one night, we'll start a new program, and it just happens like that.
Yeah.
Very
Jim, I'm really keen to hear a little bit about your passion behind the business, and you've already alluded a little to that, and I want to get to that in a little moment because I'm really fascinated. But I do just want to come back to the customer complaint side of things for a little moment because I know it's one of those things that really can be a hard thing to handle as a business owner. And I know many of the people that we train, one of the questions that comes up most often is, how do I handle negative feedback, et cetera, whether it comes through on social media or whether it's in person? You're obviously very skilled at and not afraid of dealing with conflict, especially when it comes from customers. How do you manage that? Because you've just said that, you know, when it comes to franchisees, you display that tough love, and I love that. You're in there saying this is what you got to do, but you need to go do it. But that's obviously not how you're necessarily going to handle a customer. And so how do you, number one, handle that negativity on a daily basis? And second of all, how do you not let it get you down? Because especially when you're running a small business early on, it can sometimes feel a little bit like, why am I even bothering with this? One or two really negative people can make it really difficult.
Well, customers who complain are gold. They are the essence of the business. We actually go out of our way to get people to complain. This is our survey system I told you about. But in the past, we used to just monitor complaints and count them and so forth. But then we actually, the biggest, best thing we did for a long time was actually started sending surveys out and really focusing. I mean, look, it's lovely when they're positive, and the great majority are, of course, but I didn't even read the positive ones. For the most part, it's the negative ones I'm concerned about. Because that tells you what we're doing wrong. It tells you there's a franchisee who's not returning phone calls, or why not? Mm-hmm. Or, I mean, there's various things too. Like, for example, we discovered one of the thing is people ring up or they book online, somebody has to return a phone call. Now, what was happening a lot was that people were returning phone calls and not getting through. And then the customer would complain there was no contact. Mm-hmm. And we figured out pretty quickly that people don't listen to voicemails. So now we start this process. So you've got to text. You must phone and you must text. Or when customers are complaining that they don't get a quote, the franchise has emailed the quote, it's gone to spam very commonly, or the wrong email's wrong. Okay, so you've got to confirm that with a text. So you get these processes in place and you train them and you train them and you train them and you reinforce them, and you come down hard on people who don't do it and they've stuck with a complaint. And the only way you can get rid of a valid complaint in gyms is you've got to somehow satisfy the customer. You've got to do something for them. Give them a freebie, give them their money back, do the job over again. Doesn't matter what you do, satisfy the customer. So there's this relentless focus, listening to people, things that go wrong, and saying, okay, what can we do about it? And we have systems planned now that hopefully by late next year we'll have a system that we'd call it Gym's Jobs, which is a program used by franchisees, and there's elements going to be built into that, which will, I believe, cut our complaints down by at least half. By looking at the structure of why people complain, what goes wrong, and then figuring out a way to use IT to get around it. So the people who complain are so valuable. They're your greatest asset almost.
I love that.
I love that, Jim. And I love, a minute ago you talked to us about leads and how a good person can convert 3 out of 4 leads. Well, I'm sure those processes that you identified from complaints, and by the sound of it, that's exactly where they came from, learning that, okay, we need to text people and we need to follow up emails, the conversion rate increases and the referral increases that come from good service from figuring those things out, I reckon would be key. But, Jim, I would love to ask you about epigenetics.
We
don't know a huge amount about this. I am fascinated to hear a bit more about it, but it's the background behind what you're doing and why you're doing it, right? So epigenetics, is this part of the PhD that you did? Where did this all come about? Tell us a little bit about your passion in this space.
Well, I didn't know epigenetics in those days. It wasn't really a thing back in the 70s, early 80s. I mean, the word was hardly known. But we now know that so much of character depends on epigenetics. Epigenetics, basically, for those who don't understand, you consider a DNA as a series of taps. It's like little taps that are spitting out a protein. That's how DNA works. And these things like microRNA and stuff, they get messages and they do things and they connect with other things and they make them happen. Now, what actually happens is that's fixed by heredity. But what environment does, not just your own experience, but that of your parents, your grandparents and way back, is it adjusts the taps, it turns them on. It does things like say, putting a methyl group in there, or it takes them off, so it comes. So the experience of the environment or the parents or your grandparents can actually change the way the genes function, and that has dramatic effects on character. And what actually happens when a civilization becomes wealthy and urbanized is that there's a change in character that's got to do with the way that animals control the population. And it's kind of, it's changing the psychology to people to say, hey, there's plentiful food. So, you know, you can act in a different way. For example, you can have more sex. You don't need to work so hard. Those kinds of things too, which has a big, big effect on society. So in a sense, civilization is built on a kind of an artificial fake food restriction. And this psychological epigenetic mechanism breaks down when civilizations become wealthy and urbanized. What we're trying to do is to actually work out how to reverse that process.
And so what are you currently doing or what do you believe that we all can currently do to reverse that process? We're opening a big can of worms here, but I'd love to hear a little bit more about this.
Okay. The way that societies create this civilized thing, I call it high C, basically, it's the practices built into the major world religions, okay? Control sexual behavior. Don't have sex too early of any kind, especially not in teenage years. Have reasonably tight control, not harsh control, but of infants. Do things like okay, have monogamous marriage, don't have affairs and so forth. I mean, monogamy is one of the things that drive this kind of process, because being a dedicated parent also creates the kind of character. And then having the self-discipline to do things like control yourself, control the way you eat, so you don't overeat and put on weight. That's another way of doing the same thing. Don't take drugs. Don't drink more than a very small amount. There's a whole stack of different things, periodic fasting, regularity of lifestyle, things like Sabbath keeping and so forth. Religions are kind of cultural vehicles which create this advanced character. And in a sense, that's what you've got to go back to if you can. But it's very difficult when you live in a wealthy urban society where all the social pressures are pushing you the other way.
Yeah, interesting. And I've got to ask the question, you did a PhD in history, and obviously you've spent a lot of time focusing on, like you said, the rise and fall of civilization. I'd love to know what your favourite period in time is.
Ancient Greece, the golden age of Greece. It's you can look at it, you look at a very small, like a large town, which is basically in modern terms what ancient Athens was, say late 5th, early 4th century BC, you've got an explosion of genius, which is beyond parallel, nothing like it's ever been seen before or since. You've got the birth of theatre. You've got amazing names like Sophocles, Euripides and Aristophanes, the rest, which is still known thousands of years later. You've got advances in philosophy. People like Socrates, like Plato come from that period. You've got systems of democratic government that have been innovations to the extreme. You have this magnificent creativity in terms of their vases. You've got architecture. You've got magnificent buildings. You could just go on and on. You've got the origins of modern history, like people like Herodotus a bit earlier, but Thucydides from that period. And then Xenophon, others like that. It's just such an explosion of genius. Now, what caused that? How did that happen? And why did it suddenly appear? And why did it fade away? And it's all to do with character. And character is to do with biology. And if we understand that, then genius isn't mainly about intelligence. Genius is about character. As Einstein said, it's an infinite capacity for taking pains. And the smartest people, the greatest geniuses are unnecessarily. You look at someone like Charles Darwin, for example. Now, he's one of the greatest geniuses of history in terms of what he's created. He was a very average student. His father thought he was a dullard. His lecturers, his tutors at university thought he was very average. And this guy, we're still living in his shadow. It's character.
Yep. I love it.
Wow.
So now I've got my four favourite questions I want to ask you in just a sec as we wrap up. But just as we go into that, you know, you're very passionate about seeing people be successful in business, and you nurture people into business. And I can see that that's even more important to you in many ways than the success of your company as a whole. It's how do I help nurture these people? When it comes to business, though, I think, you know, there's a real correlation between people being successful and people managing their health and happiness. And I know you're quite passionate about health and happiness right now. What's your approach in this culture that we're in this time that we're in, to being healthy and happy? And how do you, I guess, impart that to the people that are in the Jim's Mowing family?
Okay. One of my favorite sayings is no other success can compensate for failure in the home. I do not consider financial success alone as something to be, it's not the only consideration. It shouldn't be for an individual, shouldn't be for a family, shouldn't be for a business, shouldn't be for a society, okay? And I just don't think it justifies. I think a person who is fabulously wealthy but has no children, or their children are so badly brought up that they're useless, has been a failure, a failure in life. No matter how people look at them and admire them and say, hey, you're so wealthy, you've got this great yacht, you're dating supermodels, I don't care. To me, they are a failure. And that's at every stage we talk about that. Like, I read about some of these startups, these companies where people work ridiculous hours and crazy hours, and they sleep under their desks and they don't wash and this kind of stuff too. No way. If I find some of my managers working excessive hours, go home and see your family. Get out of the office. Go away. You know, we'll survive without you. Nothing is worth sacrificing your family for.
I love that. It reminds me of a game that our kids used to love to play, a terrible game, I think, and it'd be like, would you rather? And it was usually like, would you rather your left arm cut off or your right arm? And so when you're talking about this, Jim, would you rather be successful in business or would you rather have a wonderful family life? Would you rather have money? Would you rather have a legacy and an impact and make a difference and pursue your passions? So listening to you today, you've had 10 children. You've been in business for 40 years and you've set out from the beginning to fund your passion, that business is something that you've helped the people that you've come across in business as well as the vision you set out with. And I just love that you've turned this would you rather question in and said, no, that's a rotten question. Let's ask a better question. I just find that really inspirational.
Yeah. Well, I don't think it's necessary. I guess one of the things too, let me talk, be blunt about it. I am very famous. I'm not all that rich, really. I mean, we're in the top, you know, fraction of a percent of the Australian population, obviously. But, BRW want to put me on their rich 250. And I say, don't be silly. I'm not even close, okay? Because it's not a business that's been driven by short-term profit at any time, at any level. And there's a lot of decisions I make all the time, every day. Like, I'll just give you an example. This just happened just before I got on this podcast. There was a issue. We had a lady who was in a division called Pet Patrol. Now, it's one of the few divisions that's really hasn't been, it's been very hard to find work. And so what we did is we arranged for her to transfer to the cleaning division. Mm-hmm. And there were certain costs involved which can't be paid for. So the question came in, okay, so you got some money back from this thing. What about the rest? It's about $3,500. And I just said, we'll pay it. That was just about 10 minutes before I got on the phone with you, I said that. Because why? Because this lady had bought a division that hasn't gone as well, and I feel for her, and I wanted to go and have a successful business somewhere else. So it's just a decision that you make all the time. Now, you make thousands of decisions like that all the time based on the need of the person concerned. I think in the very long term it does work out because your reputation is such. But at the same time, you don't think that way.
Mm.
What is the right thing to do for this person right now? And you know, having a business that's not working very well, it's been very painful. It's a great idea, Pet Patrol, but it's just things like walking dogs and picking up dog poo and all kind of things too. It's just been difficult to get people going. Some of them have done well, but others haven't. And those who haven't, we actually arrange to go somewhere else.
Yeah.
We've given them a dog wash franchise or cleaning or something like that.
Yeah. And you're able to do that, Jim. You took your 14-year-old son to school today as well and had a chat with him in the car and fitted all that in as well. So I just think that's a beautiful balance there. Yeah. So see in the background that you have an array of books, an absolute array of books.
Now, we've got a lot of people in our community that are avid readers. I know you are very much so an avid reader. We're going to pose you with a very difficult question now. And that is, what's your favorite book to add to our accelerator book list? We can give you three if you need three.
Oh, my goodness. That is so hard. There are so many brilliant books. Yeah. I would say one book I would especially recommend to anybody is Atomic Habits.
Oh, yes.
That's about how to create good habits. That is a really, really good book. I love Stephen Covey. 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, which is a fantastic book because it talks about character. It talks about doing the right thing. This guy's a very sincere Mormon and he's just got fantastic attitude. So when you're talking about character, I finished a book just not long ago called How Not to Diet, which is about healthy eating and how the way that diet, which is really fantastic. Mm-hmm. I've just finished a book called The Secret of Our Success, which is about evolutionary biology and how our ability to learn technologies and things and systems has helped us to progress. I love Guns, Germs and Steel by Jared Diamond. That's a fantastic book. It's great. But it's also incredibly readable. You won a Pulitzer Prize for a book, which is a serious book about scientific thinking. I could just keep on going. It's very hard.
I love it.
Well, we will put those in the transcript, by the way. They will be in the notes for everybody because...
So people were frantically writing. Everyone's pulling their cars over right now to write all of this down. We'll put it in the show notes, everyone. So
if anybody wants to know, I've got a complete list of my favourite books.
Oh, wow.
And it's if you just email me, jim@jims.net, I'll send it to you.
I love it. All right, I'll tell you what, we'll email you, we'll get that list, we'll chuck it in the show notes as well. Thank you, Jim. Now, I've got to ask as well, what's your favourite quote or your quote of the moment?
Well, like the one I said before, no other success can compensate for failure in the home. In fact, I'm rewriting my business book, my Jim's book, to put that in the title, No Other Success. And start with an anecdote about a guy who was a manager in a supermarket.
Yep.
And he was leaving, and he hardly saw his kids because the money was good, but he worked incredible hours. And one morning he was leaving very early, and his little four-year-old boy said to him, "Daddy, I wish you could have breakfast with us." And he said he drove to work, tears streaming down his face, quit his job, bought a Jim's Mowing franchise, and the last 10 years, because I ring my franchise after 10 years to ask them how they're going. The last 10 years, I've said he's seen his son grow up, and there's nothing, anything that could have compensated for that lack.
Yeah.
So that's you can't go beyond that. And no. I think our values as a society, it's ironic in a way. I mean, you interview me because I'm famous and successful, but I'm almost saying that's not really the crucial thing.
Mm.
If you're going to have a choice between family and success, choose family.
Yeah.
You know, I've got two sons, both computer programmers. One works for Google. He pays a really, really lot of money. I can't believe how well they pay. He's beautiful wife. He's got two kids, two sons, two glorious grandchildren, which I love dearly. But he's successful, okay? He's rich and he's successful. And I've got another son who's also a programmer. He doesn't choose to work as a programmer. In fact, I've offered him work because he's a good programmer. He just prefers to work in his own hobby. You know, he makes his living. He actually stacks shelves in Woolworths.
Oh, wow.
Okay, that's his living, okay?
Yep.
And he's got a little son, another one on the way. He's a devoted father. He's a great husband.
Yeah.
He's successful in every way that counts.
I love that.
I'm proud of both of them.
Yeah. I love your view on success and what that actually looks like. And I think a lot of people that might, know of it, like you've just said, they sort of know of you from afar, might assume that you would have a very different view on what success looks like. But I think it's a real insight into what makes someone successful is their attitude towards that, what that actually is. And the fact that it's not chasing the money, it's chasing the lifestyle, it's chasing what's going to matter when you retire and you look back and go, did I make good use of my time, and do I have regrets, or am I happy with how I live my life? Yeah. So I love that. It's really inspirational.
Having enough money is important, and that's one of the things we aim for our franchisees. And our typical franchisee probably clears a bit over 100 grand a year based on surveys we've done. So they do okay. It's enough. It pays your rent. It pays your mortgage. You can live okay. You can educate your children. That's very important to have that. If you haven't got enough to live on, that's very bad. But having a lot more than that is not particularly helpful, and particularly not helpful if you spend it on things like status goods, having a better car or a bigger house or more expensive holidays. Those things have very little to do with satisfaction and happiness in life. Experience counts a lot more. You know, spending time with friends, going away, your family, holidays, this kind of thing, that's also valuable. But you know what you discovered the number one best way to spend money to achieve happiness? Give it away.
Mm-hmm.
Give it away to a cause that you believe in, that you're involved in.
Legacy.
Whether it's a church or whether it's a charity or whether it's a research foundation, I'm involved in my church too. That's the best way to use money. And I'm not talking to be altruistic, hair-shredded person. I'm talking about in terms of real happiness, meaningful life.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the good use of money.
Yeah, that's a really powerful message there, and I love that. I think that the why and the legacy are the two things that have shone out of this for me today. That you are a big core part of who you are and what you do and why you've built such a successful business. Two last questions very quickly. First one, if you could have a superpower, any superpower, what would it be and why?
Oh, I'd to read character. Ooh. I'd like to know no character more than anything. That'd be far better than being able to fly like Superman or X-ray vision. None of those would matter.
But he's
Oh, yes, I have. I often say this. If I could look at my franchisees, I know the great majority will be successful. If I could actually look and I could see you're not going to work out, you're not going to succeed because your character is wrong, we do our best to choose, but sometimes we make mistakes. That is really painful, and I would simply say you're failing, you can't have a franchise. I'd love to do that. And the other thing too, staff for national office. I mean, I have fantastically great staff, people like Joel that you've met. But it's really hard to get the best people.
Oh, yes.
And if I could have some way of knowing who would be another Joel, another fantastic manager, that's it. Reading people, no question.
I love it. I love that you've thought this through. I didn't actually word you up on this question. And usually when I ask it, people sit there for a few minutes and go,
Could fly.
What would I like? And you're like, bang, I got this.
Well, when you've got a 14-year-old son who likes to have, he's a very creative mind, and we have these discussions on the way. And we'll talk about things like, you know, what insect part would you like to have if you were merged with an insect biologically? That's just a typical conversation down on the way. Yeah, to school.
I hear you. We got teenagers too. It's a lot of these. But in fact,
comes into it quite a lot. You know, what would you like? And we'd be the best and stuff. Yeah, we always talk about stuff.
I love it. All right, final question. My favorite question is, if you could go back in time and say one thing to your past self, what would that be?
That's very difficult. Look, at one stage I have to say I would never change anything about my past before 14 years ago, before my youngest son was born. I would never change anything at all that would undo or change or give me different children. So in a sense, I wouldn't change the past because of that. But
if you could whisper in your own ear, though, the past.
Well, I guess in business terms, look, I didn't understand the potential of gyms, of the mowing business, for a long, long time. Mm. If I could have gone back and whispered in my ear back in 1982 without changing anything else, I really wouldn't want to change my children.
Just give yourself a message.
If I could give myself a message, I would say, hey, Jim, this mowing business could be pretty good. It took me a long while to figure how brilliant it could be.
Yep.
So we're definitely speaking to a scientist. I can tell you've watched Back to the Future, Jim, and you don't want to play with the space-time continuum.
I actually did. I did interview.
Great film. I love them.
Yeah. I interviewed a scientist only last week who has built one of the most successful direct selling companies globally. And I got to that question and he sat there and he went, I can't answer that question. And I said, why? He goes, because you can't change. You can't go back and change time. I said, no, I don't want you to change time. Just give yourself a message. And he said, no, I can't, because it could change something in
time. The butterfly
effect. Yeah. And he got quite panicky about it. And I said, this is the difference between someone who's a scientist and someone who's not, because he really was quite worried about it. So I think that's quite funny. But Jim, it has been such an honor and a privilege to chat with you today. And I think, you know, I've gleaned a lot from our conversation, so I'm sure our listeners have as well. So thank you for taking time out of your busy day and sharing with us. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're wonderful. It's been fun. Thank you.
Such an honor. And thanks as well, of course, for our amazing listeners for tuning in again today. I hope you've enjoyed this time with the amazing Jim Penman. And we look forward to seeing you on the podcast again next week. Bye for now, everybody.
Bye-bye.
If you love this video and you would love more help to improve your direct selling business on social media, then click on the link to join our Facebook group. I look forward to seeing you in there.